Today I'm going to talk about countertransference, a core concept in psychoanalysis. I will explore the different ways of thinking about countertransference, how various schools of psychoanalysis understand it, and how the psychoanalyst's own subjectivity can shape their transference onto the patient. So let's start at the beginning. What is countertransference? It is commonly understood as the psychoanalyst's emotional and unconscious responses to the patient. Crucially, these reactions are often entangled with the psychoanalyst's own unresolved issues, personal history, past relationships, and inner conflicts. In other words, it's not just a simple feeling in the moment, it's often deeper. Now, we often hear about countertransference alongside its counterpart, transference. Transference is when a patient unconsciously projects feelings or patterns from their past relationships onto the psychoanalyst. And in countertransference, we have this idea of unconscious reactions based on the psychoanalyst's past. But what does it actually look like? How does it manifest itself during a session? For example, we might see things like excessive emotional reactions from the psychoanalyst, maybe sudden intense anger or sadness, or even finding themselves strongly attracted to a patient without a clear therapeutic reason for the intensity. Or it could be the opposite, feeling a real discomfort and aversion, maybe wanting to pull back, or even maybe not looking forward to sessions, or wanting to cancel appointments with a specific patient. Countertransference often involves powerful feelings, either positive or negative, that go beyond the immediate context. Another way it shows up is over identifying with what the client is going through, getting too close, and losing track of important professional boundaries, crossing important lines. This might include developing an overly positive, almost idealized view of a client, maybe even wishing they could spend time together outside of therapy, which is a big red flag. Also, romantic and even sexual feelings towards a patient are definitely a form of countertransference that needs immediate attention and management. A couple more common ones is becoming really worried and preoccupied with a particular case, or just can't stop thinking about the patient, even when off duty. Or sometimes the patient's issues just touch deeply on the psychoanalyst's own personal experiences. For example, if the psychoanalyst had an abusive parent, they might react strongly. Maybe even get upset when a patient talks about their own parents' abuse. That's the psychoanalyst's own past being triggered. So it's clear from all the above examples that countertransference isn't just a small background feeling. It's an important signal that needs attention. And what are the consequences if these kind of reactions aren't addressed? What's the impact? Well, if it goes unchecked, it can seriously get in the way of effective therapy. It can affect how the psychoanalyst interprets what the client says or does. It can damage that crucial working relationship, the therapeutic alliance. It disrupts the power balance that needs to be carefully held in therapy. And ultimately, it can lead to biased treatment choices or even ethical breach by disclosing too much personal info, giving directive personal advice, or worse, forming dual relationships. Now, as mentioned above, I will explore how different psychoanalytic schools understand countertransference. I will go through its evolution. Sigmund Freud was the first to use the term, and he saw it as a problem. It was like 100% negative for him. For Freud, it was simply the psychoanalysts on unresolved conflict getting in the way, contaminating the therapy. It wasn't useful, and it needed to be kept out of the therapy room. It needed to be eliminated through the psychoanalyst's personal analysis, because for Freud, it was a problem to be managed. Things began to change with Carl Jung, whose approach on countertransference was different from Freud. Jung saw the relationship between the psychoanalyst and the patient as more mutual, a two-way process, setting the stage for a more shared or intersubjective understanding of what happens in analysis. Jung had that famous line, "The meeting of two personalities, it's like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed." That's the core of it. He saw analysis not just as the patient changing, but as a mutually transformative process. Both people are affected, both change, and this meant rejecting Freud's ideal of the psychoanalyst as a blank screen or a detached doctor. Jung insisted that the psychoanalyst is a human being with their own complexes, their own unconscious, and their own life. Jung thought that the psychoanalyst's humanity, their vulnerability, were not a problem, but it was a feature essential for the process. So for Jung, when the psychoanalyst has emotional reactions, feelings, fantasies popping up in relation to the patient, it's not just noise or personal problems. It is potentially valuable information about the patient. If the patient is unconsciously projecting certain feelings or patterns, maybe archetypal or symbolic energies onto the psychoanalyst, this can trigger similar hidden feelings or memories in the psychoanalyst's own unconscious mind. For this reason, Jung insisted psychoanalysts needed extensive personal analysis for self-awareness, integrating their own shadows and complexes. He talked about the wounded healer, because their own experience of suffering and growth isn't just a requirement, it's an ongoing source of empathy and wisdom. Jung believed that a psychoanalyst could only take a patient as far as they themselves had traveled in their own journey of individuation. Now, with Melanie Klein's work, particularly on projective identification that she developed around 1946, which is the basic idea of a fantasy mechanism, an unconscious fantasy, where parts of the patient self, parts that they cannot tolerate, that they cannot stand, such as aggression, anxiety, hate, and they get sort of split off and projected into another person, in this case, the psychoanalyst. And then the patient identifies with the psychoanalyst who now holds these projected parts. So the impact on the psychoanalyst is not just them having a bad day or reacting personally. The patient is unconsciously trying to get rid of these unwanted parts of themselves onto the psychoanalyst. So the psychoanalyst can then feel these projected emotions like anxiety or rage that isn't originally theirs. It's an induced state, as the countertransference was induced or evoked. An example of it is a psychoanalyst is working with a very needy client who often says things like, "I know I'm too much. You probably can't wait to finish the session." At first, the psychoanalyst reassures the patient and feels empathy. But over time, after several sessions repeating similar comments, the psychoanalyst begins to feel drained, impatient, and even irritated, almost wishing the session would end quickly. Now, the psychoanalyst is feeling what the client is most afraid of, that they are a burden. And this emotional state is induced. In Melanie Klein, the psychoanalyst becomes the container for those overwhelming feelings, the fragmented parts of the self that the patient just cannot bear yet. So in Klein, countertransference is induced, evoked by the patient's suffering. Now, Donald Winnicott was another departure from Freud. He saw it as a valuable source of information. Winnicott wrote a famous paper called Hate in the Countertransference from 1949, where he explores the idea that the psychoanalyst may experience negative feelings, including hate, towards their patients, particularly those with severe personality disorders. He argued that acknowledging and understanding these feelings, rather than suppressing them, is crucial for effective therapy. Winnicott stressed the importance of the psychoanalyst's own analysis and ongoing self-reflection to tell the difference between, is this my own issue or is it provoked by the patient? And that distinction remains crucial. Donald Winnicott also makes a distinction between subjective countertransference, which is the psychoanalyst's own baggage, the unresolved material getting in the way that still needs attention, and the objective countertransference, which is when the psychoanalyst's feelings or reactions are actually a true reflection of the client's inner world or behavior, not just the psychoanalyst's own personal material. An example of objective countertransference is, if a client is feeling very sad but doesn't say anything, the psychoanalyst might suddenly feel sad too. This feeling is objective because it comes from the client's real emotional state, not just the psychoanalyst's own feelings. Jacques Lacan took a different position. He almost rejected the usual way countertransference was understood, especially by ego psychologists and the British Object Relations School. And this was a major shift and even controversial. Lacan focused on returning to Freud's original ideas, but with his own specific interpretation, pointing out where he believed others, like ego psychologists, had misunderstood what went wrong. He felt ego psychology focused too much on strengthening the ego, helping people adapt to reality. And Lacan wasn't interested in that approach, as his focus was on the unconscious, not the ego. And counter-transference for Lacan was part of that problem. He saw it, especially the idea of the psychoanalyst using their feelings to understand the patient, as mainly happening in what he called the imaginary register. The imaginary register for Lacan is the world of images, identifications, mirror relationships, and illusions. It's where the ego lives, constantly comparing itself, identifying with things like two egos looking at each other. And Lacan thought when a psychoanalyst gets caught up in their personal feelings, trying to empathize or mirror the patient, they are just getting stuck in this imaginary register, which is all about ego and illusions. For him, this was just the ego getting in the way of true analysis. For Lacan, that's ego-to-ego battle, meaning the patient's ego interacting with the psychoanalyst's ego, which only strengthens the patient's illusions instead of going to the unconscious level. So, for Lacan, if a psychoanalyst is feeling strong emotions, it's not an insight into the patient. For him, strong counter-transferential feelings are a sign of the psychoanalyst's own unconscious resistance. In other words, that's the psychoanalyst's resistance. It means the psychoanalyst is letting their own imaginary material, their own unresolved issues, get in the way of their main job, listening to the unconscious speaking through words. In Lacan, the position of the psychoanalyst is to listen carefully and deeply to the patient's speech, the chains of words, the slips of the tongue, the jokes, the way symptoms are spoken. That's where the unconscious reveals itself. Emotional responses from the psychoanalyst are seen as potentially interfering with the listening process, and that asymmetry and imbalance are key. Lacan insisted on the fundamental asymmetry, on the fundamental difference between the psychoanalyst and patient. The psychoanalyst is not a peer, nor a friend, and not relating as one person to another in an equal, everyday way. For Lacan, seeing counter-transference as a shared emotional moment risks collapsing that difference, turning analysis into a simple conversation between two egos instead of a process that helps the patient, Lacan calls subject, to face their unconscious truth as it reveals itself in language. So, to summarize, Freud saw counter-transference as an obstacle, a problem, and the psychoanalyst needs analysis to eliminate it. Jung saw it as a mutual transformative process. Both patient and the psychoanalyst are affected. Both change. Melanie Klein saw it as a container for the patient's feelings. And the psychoanalyst starts to feel what the patient cannot bear. Donald Winnicott saw it as a valuable source of information. The psychoanalyst's feelings could offer insight into the patient, but only with careful self-reflection to separate what's mine and what's theirs. Lacan saw it as a form of resistance, a clash of two egos, the psychoanalyst's ego and the patient's ego. For Lacan, counter-transference pulls the psychoanalyst into the imaginary register, blocking access to the unconscious.